Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back here to the Audio Stash today. It's Thursday, November 15th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal. Help us end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org to make your donation or join Normal today. We always have Donate Now links up at normalaudiostash.com, up on the Normal MySpace page, and up on Normal's Facebook cause, which now has over 300,000 members to the cause. Great presence out there. So if you're on Facebook, make sure to look up Normal out there. We have links to it at normalaudiostash.com. And on Thursdays, folks, after 4:20, Normal releases the weekly press release. Some very important stories out in the press release this week. You can always get the weekly Normal News audio podcast as well up on iTunes. A look ahead at some of the headlines today. Cannabis spray effective long-term in pain treatment, study says. A very important new study looking at the long-term administration of the oral spray consisting of natural cannabis extracts called Sativex. Also from Washington, D.C. this week, U.S. marijuana market saturated, pot prices to fall, federal report says. Very interesting. Domestic marijuana production has risen so dramatically in recent years that it will likely result in reduced retail prices for pot. More information about that story on Normal's website at norml.org, and we'll have links to it at normalaudiostash.com as well. And this month, on December 1st, Normal kicks off the 24th annual Key West Legal Seminar, one of the longest-running continuous events every year in Key West. Some of the top criminal defense attorneys gather and discuss marijuana law, marijuana policy, how they try cases. If you're an attorney and you're interested in joining the Normal lawyers down there, the Normal Legal Committee, just head on up to norml.org to find out more information about that. In our program today, we've got some great music later on. Up at the Independent Online Distribution Alliance, one of my favorite bands, Cake. They put some B-sides up at the Independent Online Distribution Alliance. We'll have a B-side here today. Also in the program today, and coming up first, is Normal Conference 2007 Audio. Thursdays have really been the day where we've been releasing a lot of this Normal Conference audio. Of course, you can get a lot of the speeches up on the Normal Events podcast as well. We have links to those at normalaudiostash.com. Today, we're going to hear Marsha Rosenbaum open up the Straight Dope You've Got Questions, We've Got Answers panel. And she reads a great piece from Paul Armentano. And also, we'll hear Dr. John Morgan. We had heard the first part of this panel previously with Dr. Mitch Earlywine and Harry Levine. But here's Marsha Rosenbaum and Dr. John P. Morgan at the Normal Conference in Los Angeles this October.
It's not so much our questions that actually, frankly, worry me. It's the questions of those people out there who are largely misinformed about marijuana. We at the Drug Policy Alliance have a project called the Safety First Project, in which we outreach to parents. We do drug education for parents, largely with teenagers. And in workshops and through our website, we're always getting questions. And regarding marijuana, which is the mostly, the widest question asked, we get questions about the gateway theory, about lung cancer, about addiction, but most of all, we get questions about potency. So I'd like to share with you, to open the panel, an article that I wrote with Paul Armentano, who is the person I went to consult with when I wanted real information. So really, what's going on with potency? So I'm going to take a few minutes and read to you this article. Heard the latest buzz about cannabis? Word on the street is that today's pot is exponentially more powerful and thus more dangerous than the marijuana available some 20 or even 10 years ago. The nation's drug czar says so. He says, we're no longer talking about the drug of the 1960s and 1970s, John P. Walters recently warned. This is pot 2.0. Law enforcement says so. Speaking to the Associated Press in June, United States DEA Special Agent Mark R. Troville said, quote, this ain't your grandfather's or your father's marijuana. This will hurt you. This will addict you. This will kill you, end quote. Pot dealers say so. Advertising to your clientele that you sell only the most potent weed is an effective marketing tool, after all. Even most pot smokers say so. Admit it. Who among you is going to tell your friends that you smoke swag? Of course, just because people say something isn't enough to make it so. Truth is, much of the marijuana available on the market today, just as in past decades, is fairly low-strength commercial-grade weed. But don't take our word for it. Read what the DEA has to say. According to the agency's 2005 handbook, Drugs of Abuse, of the more than 4,600 domestic samples analyzed by the government between 1998 and 2002, fewer than 2% were found to contain THC levels above 20%. A more blunt assessment, pun intended, comes from the U.S. National Drug Intelligence Center, which states, most of the marijuana available in the domestic market is lower potency commercial grade marijuana. Perhaps the most reliable source when it comes to the subject of marijuana potency is the University of Mississippi, which has been randomly testing seized samples of cannabis for THC for over two decades. According to the university, average pot potency has increased over the past decades to roughly 8% THC. That said, there's nothing remotely or uniquely dangerous to health about consuming weed that's 8% THC. Unlike alcohol or even aspirin, today's pot still poses no risk of fatal overdose, regardless of its potency. In fact, any physician can prescribe a pill that's 100% THC, and nobody at the drug czar's office seems to mind. Moreover, cannabis consumers readily distinguish between low and high potency marijuana and moderate their use accordingly. In addition, despite claims that marijuana alters the brain, it is important to note that THC, regardless of its potency, is surprisingly non-toxic to the adult as well as the teenage mind. Recently, scientists at New York's Nathan S. Klein Institute reported that they could find, quote, no evidence of cerebral atrophy or loss of white matter integrity, end quote, attributable to cannabis use in the brains of frequent adolescent marijuana users. But what about the suggestion that today's pot is so strong that taking just one puff is a one-way ticket to drug rehab? Predictably, the devil is in the details. Data from the Federal Drug and Alcohol Services Information System confirms that more individuals are enrolled in drug treatment for pot now than ever before. However, the increase is a direct result of the fact that more Americans are being arrested for pot now than ever before. In fact, a new study reports among 27,000 plus adults entered into Texas drug treatment between 2000 and 2005, a whopping 77% of them were diverted to treatment as a condition of sentencing, probation, or parole. Faced with the choice of jail or attending drug treatment, most minor pot offenders understandably choose treatment, whether or not they need it. So if today's pot is essentially the same plant it's always been, with any marginal increase in potency akin to the difference between, shall we say, a cup of tea and an espresso, why is the government claiming otherwise? Mainly to scare parents, particularly those millions of parents today who may have, without incident, experimented with marijuana in the 1970s when they were about the same age as their children are today. Fortunately for them, while the Fed's latest reefer rhetoric may sound alarming, there's little substance behind the hype. Thank you.
That was Marcia Rosenbaum at the Normal Conference this October. Coming up next on that same panel, Dr. John P. Morgan, co-author of Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts, and professor emeritus of pharmacology at the City University of New York.
John P. Morgan.
Thank you. That didn't make it go off. Oh, okay. It did. It's a pleasure to be on this panel, a real pleasure, despite the fact that none of the talks are related much one to another, but it's still a pleasure. My title is Plants, Medicine, and Drugs. Human therapy begins, historically and other ways, with the consumption of herbal agricultural products. We search for plants as drugs, as we search for plants as foods. Somehow, somewhere, humans found it positive to ingest preparations from the kola nut, the ephedra species, the coca bush, cannabis, opium, tobacco, foxglove, and even willow bark. Now, pharmacology, the formal study of therapy, begins with the study and understanding of the chemistry of the plant preparations that we've talked about, and the reaction of those plant preparations with biological tissue, with human cells in the human body. I'm going to, at this point, rapidly skip over approximately 1,000 years and tell you that the plants yield chemicals. The chemicals bind to substructures on human cells, which pharmacologists have come to call receptors. We have receptors in our body, No reason we shouldn't respond to drugs, because we have receptors that bind the chemicals of the plant. That chemical receptor binding of various sorts, various cells, various chemicals, changes the function of the cells. And of course, if we find that change positive, we're prone to go back to that plant and try it again. And in fact, if we find that plant positive enough, we go back and pick the and identify the best ones and plant the seeds from that. So that over human history, there has been a tendency to find the desirable plant, convert it to an agricultural product, make sure you have plenty of it, and spread it throughout the entire culture. But remember, the issue is the chemicals in the plant, or the chemical in the plant, that binds to the human cell and changes its function. I said I'd skip over 1,000 years. The study in pharmacology of plant chemicals is really only about a century and a half old, and that's being generous. We analyzed morphine and coca in early parts of the 19th century. We had some idea of what the structure was like. But the study of the plant and its yield of the chemical and the application of those chemicals to biological substrates, either experimental or therapeutically, really only begins in the 1890s in the United States. The most important early plant yielding information to pharmacologists was the ephedrine plant, the ephedra species, called some parts of the western United States Mormon tea or Jerusalem tea. So the interest in early pharmacologists in the ephedrine plant led for them to study the structure of the chemicals from ephedrine and find out what they did to human cells. Okay, now I'm going to change and talk as an introduction about the opium plant. What's in the opium plant, which humans have been using for thousands and thousands of years? And of course, they used them for thousands and thousands of years before they knew what was in it. But I'll quickly skip ahead and tell you that the most important chemical in the opium plant is morphine. Morphine makes up approximately 10% of the weight of the opium plant, maybe 15% in some extraordinary species. It came as no surprise to me when I looked in some old opium books to find out people extolling opium from certain places. The opium from Afghanistan was better than the opium from Egypt, which was better than the opium from Java. And people had really strong feelings about the kind of opium you should smoke. The reality is, probably, though, all that mattered was the amount of morphine in that particular plant. Now, does opium have other characters, other chemicals? It certainly does, and I want to mention only a few. It has some alkaloids, chemicals related to morphine. There's a little codeine in the plant, which doesn't matter very much because the morphine predominates. There's also a compound called thebaine, which is similar to morphine and can be used for the synthesis of other chemicals. So once pharmacologists and chemists elucidated what was in the plant, they could manipulate what they found and make other chemicals. The first semi-synthetic chemical was heroin. Heroin is made by a simple chemical treatment of morphine. We use thebaine and codeine to synthesize such things as oxycodone, Percodan, hydromorphone, hydrocodone. So we have a large number of chemicals which are fairly valuable, which we've made by looking carefully at the structure of the plant and manipulating the chemicals that are in there. There are some other chemicals in the opium plant which don't matter. Interestingly enough, there's one other therapeutically important chemical in the opium plant which has nothing at all to do with a sedative narcotic property, and that's a funny drug called papaverine, which happens to be in the opium plant. But searching the opium plant led to other kinds of therapeutic issues. So now, let me quickly say to you, there are four kinds of chemicals that bind to the opium receptor, to the opiate receptor in humans. One is, of course, morphine and the other constituents of the plant, codeine, morphine and codeine. Secondly, there are the semi-synthetic chemicals, which we make from things in the plant. They bind to the receptor, and that's oxycodone and hydromorphone, the stuff that's in Vicodin, hydrocodone. Now, once pharmacologists and chemists learned about the constituents of the plant, what could they do? They could synthesize other chemicals. So we have a group of chemicals which are useful in the treatment of pain and other conditions, which we made with the lesson of the structure of morphine. What are those chemicals? Methadone, propoxyphene or Darvon, fentanyl. These are chemicals which bind to the opiate receptor and cause important changes, even though they may not bear much resemblance to morphine, but they bind to the opiate receptor. Now, there's a fourth kind of chemical that binds to the opiate receptor. I mentioned what's in the plant. I mentioned semi-synthetic products. I mentioned completely synthetic products. The other kind of chemical that binds to the opium receptor is made, strangely enough, by the mammalian brain. So that receptor was not put there by God or whoever to bind to chemicals in the wild. It was put there to bind with chemicals that we made. We make morphine-like compounds on our brain, which bind to the opioid receptor, endorphin, encephalin, dynorphin. These are compounds that are part of our normal physiology and explain the presence of the structure, of the opiate structure. Now, with whatever time I have left.
You have about 7 minutes.
Oh, excellent. 7 whole minutes. God am I. Let me tell you a joke. No, I won't. Let me switch to talking about the plant, which in fact brings us here today. Now, for a long time, all over the world, thousands of years, people have been ingesting the cannabis plant, products of the cannabis plant. They sometimes made beverages. They sometimes made preparations difficult to make by scraping the resin off. They'd sometimes smoke the leaves. They did a variety of things for thousands and thousands of years. Now, of course, the process that I described, people becoming interested in the chemistry, pharmacologists becoming interested in the structure of chemicals that were found, the manipulation of those structures, the finding that those structures bound to receptors in the brain, and the finding that we make something that binds to those receptors as well. There are endocannabinoids, the same four that I talked about with opium. Now, the cannabis plant is a... Well, it's a synthesizing machine. There are probably more than 60 cannabinoids in the plant if you analyze them carefully. There are also a few cannabinoids that only exist after they've passed through the mammalian liver. There are a few cannabinoids that we make that are not found in nature, and some of them actually even work. But by and large, most of the activity of the plant is attributable to a single chemical, delta-9 THC or THC. There are other chemicals in the plant that have some activity. But again, their concentration is so low that we assume most of the activity is generated by the delta-9 THC. Now, the process I talked about before, can we make chemicals that resemble delta-9 THC and see if they're better, easier absorbed, work at lower doses, work at higher doses, can be delivered in some other fashion? Well, of course we can. In fact, some of the first experiments ever done were on an unusual compound called synhexyl, which is probably a semi-synthetic cannabinoid. That's back in the 60s and 70s. Then I want to talk just for a short time about an interesting compound. People knowing this history, knowing that people love to use the cannabinoid plant, began focusing on the history, and Dr. Mashulam is the most important person to identify THC and the other cannabinoids. Then in the 1970s and early 80s, a drug company in the United States named Eli Lilly began to work very hard to make a synthetic cannabinoid that would bind to the receptor and cause some of the positive effects of the plant. It's interesting you should know that in the 70s, people at Eli Lilly were well aware of the reputation of THC or raw cannabis to decrease nausea and vomiting, to change appetitive behavior, a variety of other things. So in 1985, the United States government approved the marketing of a synthetic compound called nabilone. Some of you have heard of nabilone. It was marketed in the United States in 1985. The most interesting thing was, very illustrative, Eli Lilly gave up on the marketing of nabilone because our friends in the DEA insisted that Nabilone only be marketed with the rigors of it being classified as a Schedule II drug, which meant the companies had to account for it. It means physicians had to account for its prescription. It means that it had to be held under lock and key. So the rigors of being a Schedule II drug caused Eli Lilly to say, screw this. And they quit. They withdrew the compound from the market in 1989. I tell you this point because it is an important illustrative of the fact that it's importantly illustrative that the DEA and our governmental foolishness gave people searching for other benefits of the cannabinoid the same kind of trouble they gave to farmers. In other words, we can't have cannabis because we're keeping that illegal, and we can't have Nabilone because it needs to be classified as a Schedule II drug. Now, Nabilone was then marketed in Canada by a company who bought it from Eli Lilly, and interestingly enough, in the year 2006, this company, the Valeant Company, applied for marketing in the United States again. So Nabilone is now available in the United States again, sold as Sesamet. I don't think much of it is sold, but it works perfectly well. It binds to the cannabinoid receptor, decreases nausea, that's its main indication. Now, when one begins to work with the chemical in the plant, one can make many, many different versions of that plant. First of all, one can synthesize the plant, can synthesize the chemical. We synthesize the THC that's marketed in the United States as dronabinol or marinol. We've synthesized other cannabinoids. There's an interesting Pfizer compound called levonorgestrel, which appears to be an excellent pain reliever, but Pfizer's not interested in trying to move forward with the marketing because of the difficulty that occurs when you try to go against the DEA and the government by marketing a cannabinoid-like compound. Now, when I talked before about opioids, I didn't mention an interesting set of chemicals, which are receptor blockers. If you can make a chemical that binds to the receptor, we hoped that it would activate the receptor and cause this effect to come about. Also, chemicals that resemble the active chemical of the plants can act as receptor blockers. And one can synthesize from thebaine a compound called naloxone. Naloxone is in the emergency room of every emergency room on Earth. I think that's probably a true story. I made it up, but it's probably true. Because naloxone will rapidly reverse the symptoms of opiate overdose. And if you're in a city where people are injecting heroin or taking other compounds in a careless fashion, an opioid receptor blocker is a critically important drug. So naloxone, which came about by this process, finding out the chemicals that resembled morphine would sometimes block the opiate receptor, have led us to an important therapeutic advance by blocking the receptor. In fact, in the United States nowadays, physicians in private offices, if they get certified and educated, can treat heroin dependence with a compound called Suboxone. Suboxone is a marvelous compound. And that is, there's an opiate agonist, a compound that binds to the receptor and makes it work, called buprenorphine. But then with that, we mixed an opiate antagonist, naloxone. And we have people put it under their tongue. Why? Because buprenorphine is well absorbed from under the tongue, while naloxone is not. Now, why would we do that? So people won't inject it. So it won't get diverted. It won't get diverted and be injected by the heroin-using population. So this mixture of a blocker and an agonist is a good mixture. Now, I do want to close by talking about recent interesting experience with a cannabinoid receptor blocker. Chemists, pharmacologists found a cannabinoid receptor blocker. And the Sanofi company, a French company, began doing a variety of studies with this compound, which is sometimes called Rimonabant, sometimes called Acomplia, and discovered that it had an enormous money-making potential. Can anybody guess why? Diminished appetite. So it's an anti-munchy drug. By blocking the cannabinoid receptor, whether the individual is a doper or not, he loses his appetite. He also diminishes some other appetitive behaviors, such as his alcohol consumption and his tobacco consumption. Now, the drug company got very excited about Rimonabant, and they excited a lot of other people, including me. The only drug company stock I've ever purchased in my life here's an interesting confession, is stock in Sanofi, because I thought Ramona Bant was going to come to the market and begin making billions of dollars. It may still, but it's been impeded in its entrance to the market because of a study that showed that some people who took Ramona Bant had those depressive suicidal thoughts. There was no proof that they killed themselves more often, but this, of course, worried people legitimately a lot. And so Ramona Bant's entrance to the market has been stalled by this finding that blocking the cannabinoid receptor caused some problems for the users. Now, I'll close by saying that the blockage of Ramona Bant's progress to the market made some of my friends in this movement happy, because they're fans of natural product, multi-cannabinoid product, fans of herbalism, I might say. Now, I'm not going to say a whole lot more about that. I still believe that Ramona Bant is going to come to the market. I still believe that cannabinoid analogs may end up being extremely useful. And we need to be open in our minds to the process of pharmacology, the manipulation of active chemicals, and the production of unusual therapeutic advances in areas that we didn't even expect. Thank you.
Dr. John P. Morgan there, co-author of Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts, professor emeritus of pharmacology at the City University of New York, speaking at the Normal Conference 2007 in beautiful Los Angeles there. That was the Straight Dope. You've got questions, we've got answers panel. We have more information about the Normal Conference. You can check out photographs and hear some of the speeches, check out some video online. Right up on Normal's website, you can link to it through the homepage. We have a direct link to all of the Normal Conference material right up at normalaudiostash.com. Stay tuned. Music coming up next.
What's up, guys? This is Miss High Times 2007, and you're chilling with us here at the Normal Podcast.
76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Strop, and I founded the organization in 1970.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Contact us at Normal, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
We found some cool music this week up on the Independent Online Distribution Alliance. Found some Ween. We're going to play the Ween next week. Today, we've got Cake. This is off a B-side, and it's a rainy, gloomy day throughout most of the Northeast, and some of the country like Georgia is praying for rain. So this is a nice rain song. Here's Cake with It's Coming Down. We have links to Cake right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com.
coming down. It's coming down. It's coming down. You lie on the floor. She's slamming your door. She's gone and she's wearing your red sweater. It's coming down, it's coming down, it's coming down. It's coming down, it's coming down, it's coming down.
Cake here on the Audio Stash. B-side, It's Coming Down. Great band, Cake. Found that up at the Independent Online Distribution Alliance. We have links to Cake and the Iota up on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Stay tuned. Tomorrow's going to be a great show. Our regular weekly segment with Steve Bloom and our celebstoner.com update. We're also going to have some great music tomorrow. Make sure to tune in every day to your free stash, Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Hey, is it 420 yet? This is Rick Cusick from High Times Magazine, and you're tuned into Normal's Audio Stash.
You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 420 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.